Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. And with us, as always with ATLS, is Mike Sharma. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Chip. How are you doing?
Good, good. I am getting to sit with you today, and that's always good news. And this time, we're going to be talking about, of course, ATLS, but this time we're on Chapter 8, which is all about musculoskeletal trauma. What do you think of that?
This was our bread and butter when we were in Afghanistan, because that's what was the most exposed to things like IEDs and gunshot wounds was our extremities. The rest of it was covered up with helmets and body armor. So we had to be masters of musculoskeletal trauma and minimizing the effects of trauma with regards to exsanguination, bleeding out. So I've been waiting for this chapter the entire time, frankly. So I'm thrilled to get to it today.
Awesome. And I feel like, you know, musculoskeletal trauma, we see so many of these that can be isolated injuries or maybe ones that just really aren't that bad, all the way up to, you know, traumatic amputations and severe crush injuries and projectile and blunt trauma wounds that can be quite severe. So it really is something that, you know, sometimes it can be really subtle, and sometimes it can be easily missed, especially in our polytrauma patients. Like, I'm less concerned about the, you know, person with maybe a trivial finger fracture when they're bleeding out in multiple areas because they were, you know, ejected from a vehicle and they have severe traumatic brain injury and stuff like that. You know, if I forget the finger fracture, it's probably not a big deal in the grand scheme of things. But then again, if I have someone with like a scapholunate dislocation that gets missed, that was really their only complaint, that's a much bigger deal. So I think it's one of those things that, and again, it's a continuum, and this is one that ATLS, I feel like they try and cover the continuum, but realistically, as with pretty much everything ATLS, it's focused more on the severe end of trauma. So just keep that in mind as we're going through this podcast.
I think there's an interesting, not, I wouldn't say controversy, but just a different perspective that we had in the military and even in the military version of ATLS, where our priorities are kind of changed because of the patterns of wounding you get overseas or in combat trauma, battlefield trauma. And we're going to get into that pretty quickly here.
Yeah. So let's go ahead. Where should we start off at, Mike?
Well, I think the opener, I always like to go with the opener of the chapter because it kind of sets a theme. There's a little sentence with the title page here, and here it is. Injuries to the musculoskeletal system are common in trauma patients, but what you were saying is the next line, the delayed recognition and treatment of these injuries can result in life-threatening hemorrhage or limb loss, and I'll add there, or, you know, kinds of disability, things like that, functional limb loss versus, you know, absolute limb loss, right? And what I think is tricky here is this. The next introduction part says that these are often traumatic injuries. Like, someone is missing an arm, missing a leg. Like, that's an attention grabber. But what they're saying in the ATLS manual, and I take some issue with it, is these traumatic injuries only infrequently cause immediate threat to life or limb. And I really think it depends on the story, the history, the method of wounding here. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely agree with that. And it's kind of funny because it a little bit depends on your practice environment too. So for example, you can have some really nasty tendon lacerations, and sometimes you might think of them as being more minor, but when you talk to a specialist, they want to see them that day. And then vice versa, you think that there's a devastating injury or at least a significant injury, and then it may not be something that needs to be managed immediately by a subspecialist or whatever. So it's kind of one of those, it can be a little bit challenging in it. And I tend to lean a little bit on my orthopedic or trauma colleagues to help me navigate which way is the best way to go, because sometimes you'll be led astray if you just think based on what you are looking at as far as what's the real danger and what isn't.
I have seen some variability as well with our consultants.
Okay, so this is something that I found kind of interesting, and I'd love your feedback here, Mike. So this is another kind of text here. Musculoskeletal trauma does not warrant a reordering of the ABCDE priorities of resuscitation, but its presence does pose a challenge to clinicians.
Yeah, I take real issue with that, because in the military. And again, I think it has to do with the method of wounding, right? And how history, we'll get to this very soon, how history is so important in driving the train on what you do here, okay? Because we're going to talk later on. We have some interesting studies that I had dug up for other things that talk about just how quickly one of these extremity injuries can affect the course of care, the amount of resources involved in caring for the patient's ultimate, limb salvage, life salvage here. So when the mechanism injury seems to be an extremity injury, then it's of utmost importance to reprioritize your ABCDs into something like a CABCD, or MARCH is another acronym that's used here. So M being for massive hemorrhage here.
Just as a quick aside and to help go into a little more detail in case you don't remember what the MARCH algorithm is. So as Mike said, M is for massive hemorrhage. A is for airway management. That sounds a lot like our ABCDE. R is respiratory. Again, sounds like our B in the ABCDE. C is circulation, which is the same. H is for head, which sounds a lot like our disability. And then E is for everything else, which reminds us of our environmental exposure. So really, it's A, B, C, D, E. We just acknowledge the fact that, hey, if someone is bleeding terribly out of a certain spot, then we should probably do something about it. Because what do people most commonly die from in trauma? Bleeding. So if there's massive hemorrhage, get a tourniquet on there or pack that wound if it's a junctional site where you can't really put a tourniquet on. Do something to control that bleeding. So I don't know why ATLS says about like it does not warrant the reordering, because if it's a massive bleed, then it's something that needs immediate control. And I'll worry about the airway after that part.
We have oxygen everywhere, right? I mean, like we have oxygen on our pre-hospital rigs. We have oxygen in darn near every room in the hospital. We can just BVM somebody. We can provide rescue breaths, but it's really hard to put blood back into someone, which is what these folks need with exsanguinating hemorrhage, especially if we're not quick on the draw to stop it. They need blood and not just normal saline. And there's a lot more hurdles to clear to get blood into someone with regards to limitation of supply and clearing someone to get the blood. There's a lot more time involved there. So the more we can stop the bleeding early on, the more we're going to save this person resources and morbidity, mortality on the back end.
So kind of leading off to this too here is that just keep in mind, hemorrhage from long bone fractures can be quite significant. And with femur fractures, you can lose quite a bit of blood in the thigh. In fact, I remember learning in EMS that was one of the big things, like pelvic fractures, big deal, but a femur fracture can also be a really big deal, and to make sure to address that quickly because of the fact that a lot of bleeding can happen. Especially one of the things that I've noticed is we have a lot of our older people, when they have, even without a fracture, develop a rather significant hematoma in their thighs. And so even if that was just from a traumatic hematoma without a fracture, makes me remember that when I do see a fracture, that those can be rather significant rather quickly.
Yeah, it's important to get those splinted, stabilized very quickly and watch those patients super closely for changes in their hemodynamic status. The next part of the primary survey, again, kind of going back to major hemorrhage and traumatic amputation, I'm again just shocked at the mild language used by the ATLS book here. Patients with traumatic amputation are a particularly high risk of life-threatening hemorrhage. Okay, full agree. And may require application of a tourniquet. It's like, why may? Yes, like for sure put a tourniquet on. I don't know why this usage of may. And I see it very similar to how we would put somebody in a C-collar. Like, my God, we are so quick to put people in C-collars when there's the possibility of a C-spine fracture. That C-collar goes on and stays on for quite a long time, right? Well, we talked in our spine podcast episode a few episodes back about how, hey, look, once you have that C-collar on and it's holding C-spine stabilization, you can do everything else. You can examine the rest of the person and not worry about C-spine stabilization. I think of the tourniquet as almost like a sea collar. You put a tourniquet on high and tight as they saw in an extremity, then you've stabilized that injury. No more blood's coming out of that extremity, and you can continue on throughout the rest of your primary survey without worrying about how much blood is pumping out of that extremity. I'm really shocked and even somewhat frustrated about the mild praise given to tourniquets in this context.
And the only thing I can think of is, as far as maybe a reason why that mild language is, I'm thinking of like the small distal phalanx fractures that really don't, you know, if we're going to talk about the full breadth and depth here of traumatic amputations, okay, I can see why you don't necessarily put a tourniquet on that one. But I feel like that's not necessarily what type of injury they're talking about here, but it's hard to know. So, you know, with some of those where there's no active bleeding, stuff like that, I can see, but generally, you know, when we're thinking about traumatic amputations, we're thinking about the big ones, right? So to Mike's point, keep in mind, very, very low threshold to put a tourniquet on. And Mike's going to talk about that a little bit more here in a moment.
They do mention some other modalities that you can use to stop bleeding on extremities. I like pressure dressings a lot. Just get a big old wad of gauze and then tie it down with some sort of circumferential elastic bandage to concentrate pressure where you need it. That's great, you know. But then here we go again with this language. The risks of tourniquet use. Oh, the risks of tourniquet use increase with time. If a tourniquet must remain in place for a prolonged period to save a life, the choice of life over limb must be made. Almost like saying when you put a tourniquet on, you're just drawing a big black X over that limb and it's just going to go in the trash later on. And I just don't think that is backed by evidence right now. So I'm going to take this time right now to go over just two of the studies that are out there with regards to tourniquet application. And we're going to have these things in the show notes. That's going to be at www.totalem.org for this episode. Here's the first study. It is from Teixeira Brown, Emig et al. From the Texas, great state of Texas, tourniquet study group. And so this study covered 1,000 patients with extremity vascular injuries over the course of 5 years that were admitted to 11 level one trauma centers in urban settings in Texas here. About 18% of these 1,000 patients received pre-hospital tourniquets. The non-tourniquet group had almost 6 times greater odds of death than the group of patients who received a tourniquet. So non-tourniquet, 6 times greater odds of death. And patients who ultimately had to have their limb amputated, that one that was affected. The ones who received a tourniquet still had significantly lower mortality rates than those who did not. Now it's 2.9% versus 7.9%, but still, that's still an over doubling of the mortality rate in our non-tourniquet groups. Okay, I think this is powerful evidence to show that tourniquets should be used, they should be used early, and we should not be so worried about applying tourniquets. Second study here, and I'll pause for a breath because, again, I'm just so excited about this. So this is Smith, Ochoa, and Wong et al. From the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery. This is in a 2019 study. 200 patients, major penetrating extremity trauma that was amenable to tourniquet use, because there are some things that are not amenable to tourniquet use. These were about 80 had no tourniquet, about 130 had a pre-hospital tourniquet. Patients in the tourniquet group had, number one, higher average systolic blood pressure on arrival in the ED, about 120 versus 112. They required less total units of PRBCs. Get this, about 9 units of PRBCs in the non-tourniquet group versus 2 in the tourniquet group. And lastly, we see similar reduction in use of FFP units here, fresh frozen plasma, the non-tourniquet group requiring about 6 units and the tourniquet group requiring about 1.4. There was no association with nerve palsy and tourniquet use. And fasciotomy use was also higher in the non-tourniquet group than the tourniquet group, as was, by the way, limb amputation. And so it almost could be said that the tourniquet was limb preserving instead of, you know, this talk about, oh, we have to choose life over limb here. You're choosing life and limb over the alternative here. Okay. And the last thing I'll say before I take a breath and let Chip go here is that the average time, so you hear about all these amazing statistics and you go, wow, that must have been over prolonged transport time. The average time from tourniquet application to arrival in the ED was about 22 minutes. So in the course of 22 minutes of tourniquet time, we had all these resources, all of these morbidity and mortality endpoints saved. It blows me away, Chip. I think, frankly, everyone should be carrying tourniquets in their vehicle. All EMS crews should have tourniquets here. There should be just everywhere you have an AED, you should have tourniquets and bleeding control kits in the community. I'm a tourniquet advocate for sure.
This sounds like a lot like Stop the Bleed.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, I am kind of, you know, cribbing off of Stop the Bleed. But yes, I totally agree that bleeding control should be addressed very similar to early defibrillation of cardiac arrest. I totally agree with that.
Now, keep in mind, as we've alluded to as well, is that, you know, there are other modalities, not just tourniquets, although tourniquets, you know, it used to be like a use as a last resort type thing. We figured out quickly, thanks to the military in many ways, that tourniquets are safe to use early on, and so apply them early. But some parts of the body are not necessarily amenable to tourniquets, or maybe we are just trying to get more precise control. Mike mentioned pressure dressings, and the traditional pressure dressings are like these big, bulky wads of gauze that you just shove in, and it's almost like you're packing, but more externally. I am a big proponent of, if you've got a very focalized area of bleeding, seriously, like with the glove finger and just a little bit of gauze, you put it right over where that bleeding's at, you provide direct pressure right over. It's amazing. You can get a lot of bleeds that were ones that felt like they could not stop, including sometimes some silly ones like a varicose vein that's just blood because it's been scratched or whatever. And you, just with a little bit of direct pressure for a few minutes, it's amazing how many times you can get bleeding controlled very quickly. And something else that I've done, really just kind of not necessarily for these massive injuries, but just can be really helpful here, is when you suture around a vessel and then you tie it down, you can tamponade the bleeding that way as well. And I've done that for certain cases. But again, with massive bleeding, especially when we're talking about more on the extremities, like we're referring to here, have a low threshold of using a tourniquet. And another thing that I do when we're talking about like tourniquets here and whatnot is, let's say it's someone who maybe comes from the outside, whether they came by EMS or they brought themselves in or family brought them in, whatever. And maybe I just want to kind of get a good idea, but we're kind of questioning, you know, because they have a homemade tourniquet on there or something. Is there something that's more severe going on? So I actually take a blood pressure cuff and I'll put it proximal, of course, to the area of injury and either inflate it, depending on like how concerned I am, either inflate it and then start deflating it to see where the bleeding is coming from, or I'll keep it deflated and take everything off and then see what the wound looks like. Keep in mind, of course, that, you know, if you have a lot of clots or stuff like that in the way, you could have a false sense of security there. But my goal is that I want to be able to see in as relatively bloodless a field as possible the area of injury. And then if I can identify where that area of bleeding is and help control it that way, it can be very, very beneficial. So using a blood pressure cuff is kind of my way of having some control of bleeding without necessarily pulling out a specific tourniquet. But once again, if there is heavy bleeding, oh, I'm really appreciating it now that we don't have some kind of tourniquet device on there. I'm ready to put a tourniquet on there. And my blood pressure cuff is just a way of helping provide some hemorrhage control until I get a more definitive source of bleeding control going on with the more usually commercial tourniquet device.
I love that. I love the use of a blood pressure cuff. Those things are everywhere as well in your hospitals and pre-hospital settings here. One more thing you can use, again, a little more elegant perhaps than a wad of gauze and an A-strap, is something called, depending on who you ask, the emergency bandage or the Israeli bandage. But it's basically all those things, the gauze and the elastic together in one integrated device with kind of a plastic closure bar that you can use to help secure the bandage, especially for transport or moving a patient around a room. So there's lots of ways you can do this. It is an art form. There is an elegance to be used here. Like Chip was saying, putting the pressure at exactly the right place sometimes is just as good as putting a whole lot of pressure in the wrong place. And so lots of ways to do this. And shout out to my medics from Afghanistan. They were truly the artists in this art form.
So let's move on to a bit of a piece of red text here just so we can kind of talk about it. A patient with multiple injuries who requires intensive resuscitation and or emergency surgery for extremity or other injuries is not a candidate for replantation.
Yeah, I think that just speaks to the priorities. Like you kind of mentioned early on about priorities, Chip, and how depending on what the injury is and how severe it is, we worry about certain things more than others. Yeah, if someone has polycystic trauma, then the replantation is the least of our worries. They've got enough of an insult to their general vasculature that I think it's going to be really hard to do a replantation surgery, which requires a lot of, you know, good vasculature and neuro status here. They're just worried about getting the rest of this patient, the core of this patient, keeping them alive here. So I think that kind of helps us drive our priorities when we're treating these patients.
All right. So let's talk about some specific injuries here and things that we need to watch out for. One that I think about are bilateral femur fractures, because these fractures can indicate that the patient has been subject to a significant force of trauma and should alert us to the possibility of like significant associated injuries with it. Another one that I find kind of interesting are scapular fractures, because in children, they actually don't necessarily mean the same thing that we think about in adults. And with adults, scapular fractures, we think that's a heck of a traumatic force to put on the scapula, and most of the time there's going to be some underlying injury. So if we see a scapular fracture in an adult, we get a lot more concerned. As I've learned talking to pediatric trauma and stuff like that, if they see an isolated scapular fracture in younger children, they're not as concerned about it.
I bet we're going to talk about different wounding patterns and fracture patterns when we get to our pediatric chapter in ATLS. And I'm really excited to talk about that too, how it can differ, just because, you know, these aren't just little adults, as the joke goes here. There's differences in calcification of bones and where they get hard and in what order they get hard and stuff like that. So yeah, I think it really does depend on the kind of patient you have in front of you.
And let's talk about crush syndrome. Now, this is not the same thing as crush injury.
Right. So we're talking about the syndrome of thing that happens after the crush injury. You might not get all these things from the injury alone. It's kind of the downstream effects of a crush injury we're talking about with crush syndrome.
And so I think it's really important to kind of think about that for a moment, because of the fact that depending on where you're trained and what you've learned, some people get really hesitant documenting something as a crush injury because they think they're synonymous. And really, crush syndrome or traumatic rhabdomyolysis refers to the clinical effects of injured muscle that, if left untreated, can lead to acute renal failure and shock. So things that we're thinking about, like amber color urine and the presence of serum creatinine kinase of 10,000 units per liter or more. And my friends who are in the military who worked at a place where there was boot camp or you know, basic training would talk about how they were used to seeing levels of 500,000 or more. And then you really knew that someone had some real rhabdo going on then. 10,000 is just too low of a number. So I can tell who's been in the military when they start talking about that. Creatinine kinase is more of an indicator for rhabdomyolysis when urine myoglobin levels are not available. And rhabdomyolysis can lead to like all sorts of bad lists, right? So it can lead to metabolic acidosis, hyperkalemia, hypocalcemia, and the all dreaded DIC or disseminated intravascular coagulation. Initiating early and aggressive intravenous fluid therapy during resuscitation is critical to protecting the kidneys and preventing renal failure in patients with rhabdomyolysis.
Yeah, we are going to want to smash these guys with fluid pretty early on to protect those kidneys. Let's talk now about adjuncts to the primary survey. You're doing your primary survey, whether it's March or whether it's ABCDE, and you found something that you need to fix right away. Well, how do we immobilize a fracture, let's say? Okay. Well, what we're doing, number one, you know, of course, we are keeping the sharp ends of the bone from moving around. And that's just good for patient comfort. But we're also doing a lot of other things. We're controlling blood loss. We are preventing further neurovascular compromise. We're preventing further soft tissue injury. So these are all like, it's great to immobilize a fracture. And I'm so pleased when EMS crews come in and they've done their best to immobilize a fracture or suspected fracture before they even get to us. That's just less pain medication required for the patient. The patient's happier, all of these things. something that is often held until they get to the ER, which I think is appropriate, is administering antibiotics, okay? Especially with patients with open fractures, as we're talking about here. All that being said, you know, ATLS is really on this here, red text. Resuscitation efforts must take priority over splint application. And I think that's very true. Putting on a tourniquet onto an exsanguinating hemorrhage is different than putting a splint on a broken extremity here. So I totally agree with that.
Now, if you're thinking about antibiotics and you have the time to approach this and do so early, again, early antibiotic use can be very beneficial. If you're trying to think of which one, the one that's most commonly used is cefazolin, or the brand name is Ancef. And so usually you give cefazolin. The nice thing is you can do this as a pediatric weight-based dose. There's also adult weight-based dosing, and usually it's basically how big you are. And the idea there is that it is an easy to administer prophylactic antibiotic in these situations, and can be something that can be given, again, with relative ease, but something that is very commonly available in most emergency departments and hospitals.
Yeah, that's an easy one to find for sure. When do we want to get early x-rays? Okay, because sometimes you just want to cover your ABCDEs, and then you'll do your secondary survey to look for the less important fractures, like Chip was saying about, you know, our phalanx fractures and stuff like that. When the fracture is suspected as a cause of shock, like these femur fractures we've been talking about, or pelvic fractures, that's when you really want to get on that x-ray early. That's why it's so important to do, you know, when appropriate, your trauma activations, so that when the patient arrives at your ED, boom, you already have all the important people waiting at bedside, including your x-ray techs, to start shooting these important pictures. And you can do a quick, you know, wet read looking at the preliminary images instead of waiting for the radiologist to read them. So you can know right away, oh my gosh, looks like a broken pelvis, looks like a broken femur. We need to start working on this very quickly.
Keep in mind, some of these we can be really impressed by, or we can be, oh yeah, this one's broken, whatever. But the only real reason why we should forego x-rays before treating a dislocation or a fracture is if there is the presence of vascular compromise or impending skin breakdown. So if this person, you know, has a pulseless foot and they have a rather significant fracture dislocation of their ankle, which is a very common spot to see this vascular compromise and impending skin breakdown because the skin is so tinted from the bone, then yes, I don't need the x-ray there for that part. And again, this is a true concern where I need to address this as quickly as possible. This pulseless foot is the emergency. I'm going to reduce it, and then we'll worry about getting the x-rays. And that's pretty much the only time that you're going to go ahead and reduce prior to getting x-rays. For the most part, if we can, we want to get the x-rays first and then work on a plan for reduction.
Yeah, that part was actually mentioned later on, at least in the ATLS book, as far as in the secondary survey. But I would consider this as part of the D of disability of the ABCDEs. You're trying to prevent someone from having more of a disability there. So no, I think it's perfect to mention it right there.
All right, so let's move to the secondary survey.
I'm a big history taker. I love spending some extra time to understand the history. As we know, though, right, sometimes history goes a little bit later, and in big trauma, history comes second during the secondary survey. So now that you've addressed all the life threats, A, B, C, D, E, now it's time to really dig into this history beyond what you're just seeing and stabilizing here. And I love understanding, well, you know, where was the car? Where were you? How were you sitting? You know, where was everybody else? So ATLS book says really reconstruct the scene and consider what other kinds of potential injuries this patient may have sustained instead of just the ones that you can see clearly. That can be a great way to guide any sort of ancillary studies that you're going to do.
Let's think about more for a second here, like a complete physical. So for a complete examination, we want to completely undress the patient, right? Taking care to prevent hypothermia. So we're going to undress and then recover them. And the idea is that there are like three goals for assessing the extremities, and that is having the life-threatening injuries on the primary survey, the limb-threatening injuries on the secondary survey, and then we kind of conduct a systematic review to avoid missing any other musculoskeletal injuries. So that's our continuous reevaluation. And so when we're thinking about this in the grand scheme of things, you know, our pelvis fractures or even our significant femur fractures, that's primary survey. Secondary survey would be more of those fracture dislocations without neurovascular compromise, because that could be a big deal. That's limb threatening. And then again, I don't know why we're picking on the finger so much, but those finger fractures, you know, those kind of more minor, hey, my finger hurts, I'm still moving it. Okay, well, we'll get an x-ray of it once we've calmed everything else down. We've addressed all the other major issues. So that's kind of our processes here. Now, open wounds may not be obvious on the dorsum of the body, and therefore carefully log rolling patients to assess for those hidden injuries is key. But also keep in mind that when you see an open wound, especially when we're talking about the extremities, to think about an open fracture, because not always will it be very apparent. You're not always going to see bone sticking out. However, if I do x-rays over those open wound areas and I see a fracture that, you know, pattern-wise is consistent with, that may have been caused by a piece of broken bone that was sticking out and now went back inside the body again, that's an open fracture. And that's something that's going to require some prompt management, usually by an orthopedic surgeon or someone specializing in trauma, to potentially do a washout or at least a more detailed level of treatment for those patients.
Something the book emphasizes and is in the red text that kind of goes along with that, potentially more of an occult injury, is our knee dislocations. And, you know, we think of the knee as a very stable joint. Well, if it's been totally trashed, it can dislocate and then reduce spontaneously because there's not a lot of stuff keeping it from reducing after it's already been dislocated. And so, you know, we're thinking, oh, we're going to see this big, you know, swelling and bruising or big radiographic anomalies here. You may have to physically examine that joint and detect that instability clinically over radiographically here. Something to consider as well, because, you know, when you have a true knee dislocation, I'm not talking about your patellar dislocations, which are very, I feel like, low risk as far as complications here. But when you actually have a violation of the knee joint, we're really worried about the blood flow through the popliteal artery behind the knee. And so how can you verify good blood flow through there? One way is your ankle brachial index. Okay, so you're kind of checking your arterial flow on the distal lower extremity and checking it on the distal upper extremity and comparing those things, ankle to brachium. And you're seeing, is there a ratio of less than 0.9 on the ankle versus the brachium here? If so, that indicates some sort of disrupted arterial flow, and you're probably going to want to get a CT angiogram. And I'm somewhat surprised that they don't advocate for that, and that they kind of are okay with the ankle brachial index as maybe being your screening exam, because we talk about the CT angiogram later on in the text. I won't spoil it before we get there.
I was getting ready to talk about it, so I guess we'll wait about the CTA for the moment then.
Well, I think it's important because they do talk about that you should actually wait to do a CTA until you talk to a consultant. So I thought that was interesting as well.
And I think that could be potentially fair, because if you're going to refer this patient out or transfer them or something like that, then the more studies that can be done at the definitive care makes sense too. So I can see that. And I think it's one of those things that we have to at least keep in mind is that it's not going to be perfect. Another thing to also think about here for a moment is Doppler and the use of Doppler when we're talking about injuries, because that's part of what we're talking about here with knee dislocations, is that we have a vascular injury. And so if I have great equal, you know, pulses, then I'm less worried about arterial injury. But if I have any kind of question, Doppler is good. And just keep in mind that Doppler can sometimes be a bit deceiving. So I like to, with the ultrasound probe, of course, you know me with ultrasound, I'm not going to go after it. But I like to be able to see a triphasic wave on Doppler to know that that really is arterial. And if I don't see a triphasic wave, I'm not convinced it's arterial. And I want to make sure that I take other steps to help protect the arterial blood flow of that extremity. So don't discount that. And of course, we know, because we've talked about like neck and stuff like that, expanding hematomas or pulsatile hemorrhage from an open wound should also be concerning for an arterial type injury.
Let's go from our life-threatening things to our limb-threatening things. And again, kind of circling back around to our open fractures, open joint injuries. CT is a great way to identify whether someone has a superficial injury over a joint or a true disruption of the joint capsule. And what we're looking for in the CT is some sort of intra-articular gas. Now, in the rare opportunity or the rare case, rather, that CT is not available, there are old school physical exam procedures that you can do to check for integrity of the joint capsule. And that'd be something called the saline load test. And there's a whole, you know, detailed way to do this test, but the short story description of the test is you're injecting saline or dye, depending on local practice, into the joint space to determine if that dye or saline stays in the joint or if it flows out. And that can be your clue of, oh, wow, it's flowing back out of the joint. There's been some sort of violation that I just can't see on my inspection here. Now, I do a podcast with my friend, nurse practitioner Martha Roberts, called The Two View, and it's about emergency medicine for PAs and nurse practitioners. And Martha does a great summary of the saline load test on our podcast. You can find that if you search for Two View Emergency on any podcatcher, or you can go to our website to look at videos of that. It's Two View, the number two view.fireside.fm for that saline load test. But again, I think Chip and I agree here. You're going to have CT at most places, especially most definitive care hospitals. And CT, I think, is just as good, maybe even better than, depending, of detecting these violations than this saline load test. But it's a good way to do things if your scanner is down, perhaps.
Thanks for sharing that, Mike, with the Two View podcast. And you keep talking about this thing called a physical exam, but I have my doubts. I mean, we're emergency medicine. We don't know what a physical exam is, at least according to our specialists. So, I mean, you know, I'm just going to take all the images all day, and then that's the way I understand what's going on with the patient, right? I mean,
right. Yeah, that load of radiation is someone else's problem. It's not our problem.
And we're kidding.
Yes, kidding.
So antibiotics, we already did talk about cefazolin, and I don't agree with the text on this, but we are talking about ATLS. We want you to be prepared to take your ATLS test and class and everything. And it talks about if they're anaphylactic to penicillin, which is the issue I have here, because there's more and more evidence about beta-lactams and about the fact that, you know, it's more about the side chain, that not the fact that it is a beta-lactam that matters. That if they're anaphylactic to penicillin, you should use something else instead of cefazolin. So you could use clindamycin. Gentamicin is suggested with more severe soft tissue damage and substantial contamination, but also piperacillin tazobactam, or zosyn, as many of us may think about it, is suggested with farmyard soil or standing water. Yeah, another one I think about that they don't specifically talk about in ATLS is ampicillin and sulbactam, which is Unicin. And the reason why I think about that one is especially with bites. So if you have severe bite type injuries, this is a good one to give. And a lot of times people use that as a bridge to Augmentin or amoxicillin clavulanate. So it's something else to kind of just keep in mind there, is that there are these options. Now, do you want to talk about the combat guidelines?
Yeah, so we had and still do have some, we call it TC3, our tactical combat casualty care. They're kind of approved antibiotics for our military patients here. If you were able to take PO, we were giving folks moxifloxacin, so a fluoroquinolone. And, you know, debate there as far as, you know, all the bad things we hear about fluoroquinolones. I think in this situation, if we're talking about combat trauma, we're kind of going to take a risk here and go ahead and provide broad spectrum coverage and kind of let the other things kind of fall by the wayside, so to speak. If people couldn't take PO, we were going with ertapenem. We were bringing up the big carbapenem guns just because, man, we would joke in Afghanistan about how even the soil here hates us. Like, there was so much heavy metal and stuff in the soil that when someone got blown up, all that would get propelled up into the wounds and cause horrible infections. It was a hell of a thing to save somebody from trauma and have them die from infection down the road here. So we were very aggressive about antibiotics very early when we got these patients.
So let's hit a little bit more vascular. And so we've talked about how limbs can be very tricky about this because of the collateral circulation, blood flow, and stuff like that. So a non-occlusive vascular injury, such as an intimal tear, can cause coolness and prolonged capillary refill in the distal part of the extremity, as well as diminished peripheral pulses. or an abnormal ankle brachial index. That's why we like checking out our ABI, stuff like that. But it's crucial, and this is in red text, it is crucial to promptly recognize and emergently treat an acutely avascular extremity. So that's talking about, again, we don't wait for the x-rays. If it's acutely avascular, we want to try and reduce that as quickly as possible. Sometimes you may not be able to reduce it without the x-ray because you need some guidance there, but we should at least be trying to reduce this as quickly as possible. It's almost like shocking someone without sedation if they're unstable.
Going back to our ACLS podcast. Nice. Yeah. And that could be another, you know, we talk, you know, in more of the theory of ACLS, when you know that you've got an injury that you cannot definitively manage at your location, you are spinning up transport for this person and transfer. And so if you see from the jump, oh, wow, this is an avascular extremity and I can't fix this immediately, you know, this patient needs to be transferred. Get that going early and don't worry about doing some of the things that can wait until you get to the definitive care location.
So muscle necrosis begins when there is a lack of arterial blood flow for more than 6 hours, and nerves can be even more sensitive to an anoxic environment. So just keep that in mind when, again, we're thinking about how this is such a time-sensitive issue. And patients in casts can also have vascular compromise. So promptly releasing splints, casts, and any other circumferential dressings upon any sign of vascular compromise and reassessing is key. And this is a nice transition to compartment syndrome.
Oh boy. Yeah. It really chapped my butt. I was overhearing people talking one day recently, and it was a parent talking about their child who had been put in a splint in the emergency department. And, the parent talked about how the patient was complaining, the child was complaining of how the splint was kind of hurting them. And unless that ED clinician was totally off their game, probably there were instructions about how, hey, if the pain is getting worse, there's numbness or weakness here, you just need to come back to the emergency department right away. But then the parent further related about how, you know, they thought they would kind of wait it out, and so they let the patient go to sleep, and the kid woke up in the morning still having some pain. So finally, the next day after worsening pain, they went to the ER, and there was some sort of a complication with the patient here. And the response from the parent was, don't they know how to put a splint on in the emergency department? And I just really had to bite my tongue about interjecting there because you know, the patient was telling you what needed to happen. You know, the patient was telling you there's probably a complication going on. Sometimes we have to listen to the patient here. I think that, you know, what it says there in the ATLS is exactly right. Our responsibility is, number one, making sure the patient or whoever is with them is aware that, hey, any worsening of pain unexpectedly, any neurological deficit unexpectedly here, don't think about whether or not you should come back to be seen in person here. No, someone's got to see you right away. Really impressing that upon the patient, documenting, we've impressed that upon the patient here, putting in their written discharge instructions. Hey, you got to come back if you're worse. Don't just wait it out. Especially in our COVID-19 times, patients and you know, parents can be kind of reluctant to return to emergency department settings. So I, especially since that overhearing, I've been very aggressive with my patients about explaining to them, you got to come back. Even if you think it might be okay, if you feel like there's pain worsening despite taking your pain medications here, you got to come back so we can see you again. So we make sure you don't have compartment syndrome, which was Chip was kind of leading me to here. So what is compartment syndrome?
So one thing I want to interject here real quick, just because of us talking a little bit about splints and compartment syndrome, is that if a patient feels worse when we put a splint on, I don't send them home. Mm. They need to at least be feeling the same, if not ideally, and in almost every case is what's going on, they feel better with the splint on. Because to me, if they're feeling worse with the splint, something's not going on correctly with that splint. And again, we'll talk about that more here in a moment. But I think it's just, as we're talking about compartment syndrome, me watching out for signs of compartment syndrome, I don't even let them leave the department if they feel like it's worse once the splint's on.
I love that approach. I'm going to be looking and asking for that more and paying attention when they say that, that they're not better. But like you said, often they are. Just with the pure splinting and basic pain medications, they feel a ton better.
Exactly. So yeah, so go on. What's compartment syndrome?
So often extremities are contained within fascia. So fascia, I think when I explain it to people, it's almost like saran wrap, right? It's this, you know, thick layer that does not stretch very well. It doesn't accommodate, and it can really seal in this muscle. Okay. Skin too can also seal in muscle into these compartments, these closed spaces here. So what's happening in compartment syndrome? What's happening is you have swelling, whether it's swelling from damaged muscle that is kind of diffusely swelling, or you have some sort of a true vascular injury that's pumping a lot of either arterial or venous blood into one of these closed compartments. Well, if the compartment can stretch, you're going to have increased pressure in that area. And it's just like someone, you know, putting pressure on an injury and continuing to push and push and push harder. Eventually, they're going to compromise your vascular status and your neurological status as well. And I think, you know, the text says here, early diagnosis is the key to successful treatment. And I love what Chip said there about, hey, you better be better after I gave you pain medication and splinting. Otherwise, am I diagnosing compartment syndrome early in you? If you're telling me you're not better after all those things.
Just as a friendly reminder of the like kind of signs you're looking for with compartment syndrome, think of it as like being the five or six P's. We think about pain, obviously, pallor. So, you know, pale skin tone, paresthesias and numbness feeling, pulselessness. So like a faint or absent pulse, paralysis is another one. And then the one that I love that is kind of the new one for the six P's is poikilothermia. I feel like that's a hell of a stretch there. Someone was really, really trying to get there. So what's poikilothermia?
Yeah, poikilothermia is decreased warmth in the extremity. So yeah, that's a great thing to notice if it's there, but you shouldn't let it get to that point. It's almost like people talk about like, well, what are you going to see with a tension pneumothorax? Well, I'll see tracheal deviation. And it's like, well, yeah, you will if you don't catch it, right? Like, you don't want to let it get to the point where you have poikilothermia, pallor, pulselessness, paralysis, all those things.
So I really like this part. Compartment syndrome, this is in red text. Compartment syndrome is a clinical diagnosis. Pressure measurements are only an adjunct to aid in its diagnosis. So the reason why this matters so much to me is even though I'm not in the smallest of hospitals by any means, I'm not in truly anymore in a critical access hospital, we actually don't have a way to measure pressures. And so it's a convenient excuse for our orthopedics to be like, oh, you know, we can't measure the pressures here. They need to go somewhere else where they can do that. Like, come on, man, this is a clinical diagnosis. Like, you know, you're going to make fun of me for my exam. I can make fun of you now for your exam. So let's be real here. So just remember, compartment syndrome is a clinical diagnosis. And if there is any question, immediately obtain surgical consultation for suspected or diagnosed compartment syndrome. And again, the absence of pulses, don't rely on that because that's a late finding. It's not necessary to diagnose compartment syndrome. It's the other parts, even some variation and some combination of these findings. We just want to have a lower threshold so we make sure not to miss this important diagnosis.
I was going to say it goes without saying, but I'm going to say it. Of course, if there is something on there, a splint or even a bandage or whatever else here, you're taking that off the patient if you're seeing that there is something going on that could be going on the road of compartment syndrome. We're trying to decrease the pressure on that extremity. Something else to consider, especially with regards to patients who have fractures and fracture dislocations, is neurological injury. So there can be some pressure or straight up transection of a nerve from a fracture or dislocation here. There is a great table in the ATLS manual. Instead of going through all the different kinds of associated particular peripheral nerves that go along with associated particular fracture dislocations here, I think you just look at the table. We're going to have a table in the show notes at www.totalem.org. But look at that. It's a great way to use your clinical skill and go, ah, they have this injury. I'm going to test for this particular nerve deficit. And if it's present, the deficit is present, I'm worrying about this nerve injury. Or that also shows that you know as a clinician what nerves are encircling that injury area, the fact that you are testing for, documenting the presence of good neurological sensation and function to that nerve, I think just further hammers home just how smart of a cookie you are.
I was about to say, can really impress your orthopedic surgery colleagues when you can actually tell them what you've done and how you've identified what nerves involved. So it's fantastic. You'll actually sound like you did do a physical exam instead of just CTing the patient and seeing what happened. So let's talk about, as we're wrapping up here, our podcast, which we always seem to manage to make around an hour or so, because why not? We enjoy talking to one another. Let's go over some extremity injuries, contusions, lacerations, stuff like that. We see all the time and in varying degrees of severity. Sometimes this does need to go to surgery. A lot of these we are managing in the emergency department. One that I find a particular pain that could sometimes be one that maybe needs operative management because of its ability to chop up a tendon into little pieces or cause some significant injuries to the nerves or other underlying structures, or may just require a lot of debridement and surgical washout. There's a variety of them, but one that I'm going to see because it's this time of year now, it's going to be chainsaw injuries. And chainsaw injuries are the bane of my existence right now because they're starting to come back out. Like I said, it's the right time of year for it. And chainsaws, if you haven't actually been and had the pleasure of working in this environment, they jump. And so they kind of skip along the surface a lot of times. And so they cause a series of very close together lacerations. I've got a technique of what I do to kind of bring them together again, but they are a nightmare sometimes to approximate these wounds afterwards, especially when you have 8, 10 or more, you know, kind of individual lines, you know, for your laceration and right on top of the other, that can be just a total pain to put that back together. And sometimes they'll go to surgery because they just have other things that are wrong with them. But it's one of those things, you know, sometimes lacerations can be rather complex. A lot of times they aren't necessarily that severe, but they're good to keep in mind that not everything has to be fixed in the emergency department.
Yeah, I think we all as EM clinicians pride ourselves on our suturing and our wound repair capabilities, right? Yeah, no problem. I'll put in multi-layer closures and, like, you know, we are artists when it comes to that. But we mentioned chainsaw injuries in this context because when we have a particularly deep injury or a particularly infected injury, sometimes we have to recognize, hey, it's not just about putting the meat back together. We have to get someone in there deep into that injury, maybe debride all the nasty bits of wood and grease and whatever that came from the chainsaw injury or other dirty wounding mechanism here. And maybe this is just one that's outside of our scope of practice in the emergency department. And so the depth that they specifically comment on in the manual here is extending below the fascial level. So it might be worth getting your consultant involved if we have an injury that deep, especially one as contaminated as a chainsaw.
So when a joint has sustained significant ligamentous injury, but it is not dislocated, the injury is usually not limb-threatening. However, prompt diagnosis and treatment are important to optimize limb function. And so, again, talking about certain types of ligament or tendon injuries, one that I think about are flexor tendons in the hand. Those are big deals generally. And so just make sure if you're seeing a ligament or a tendon type injury, I tend to go ahead and consult orthopedic surgery because some of them, they're going to say it's fine. You know, close up the wound externally and splint and a position of comfort, and then we'll see them tomorrow or something along those lines. But other ones are ones that they're going to say, no, this needs to see someone right away. So just make sure you're reaching out to someone, even if there isn't a fracture present.
And helpful tips there to make the consultant make their decision a little bit easier. Hey, is this person a righty or a lefty? Where is the injury? What does this patient do for a living? You know, do they work with their hands all day long, or are they kind of retired and don't need as fine of a motor control here? So all those things can help with the history, and also beyond just good patient care, prevents you from having to say, oh, I didn't ask about that. And you have to kind of go back to the patient and then come back to the consultant here.
Interestingly, hand surgeons, just want to add to that, like to know about smoking status.
Huh. Just because of the fine vasculature and how well-preserved it's going to be.
Yeah, they like to know about smoking status too. It's kind of interesting.
I'll add it to the list.
So a red text part, to exclude occult dislocation and concomitant injury, x-ray film must include the joints above and below the suspected fracture sites. So let's think about some of the ones that we think about. So Galici, Montesia, and then my favorite, the Mesa Nueve fracture. And the reason why I think about that one is just because it's fun to say, but also because I just caught one of these last week. So I was really excited. So yes, just make sure that you're pushing around the right areas to catch where these areas of pain are located. And then let's talk about some principles of mobilization, which I feel like we could like dive into and make it our own separate podcast about, you know, how do we take care of each of these fracture types and stuff like that. But there are some key points that Mike and I went over to kind of come up with this maybe a little more concisely.
Yeah, I think you read your ATLS manual just so you understand the finer points here. But principle one, to kind of like summative principles of immobilization here, did you immobilize the extremity, right? People who are new at casting and splinting, they get really wrapped around the axle of how pretty it looks and did everything lay down just right or whatever else here. Look, if the person can still move the extremity, you did it wrong. But if they can't move the extremity or joint, hey, you did it right. And there are some additional fine points we're going to get to soon, but that's job number one. Did you actually immobilize the extremity? And that can be with something as fine-tuned as, you know, orthoglass or whatever generic term you would use there as far as a padded plaster cast there. That's something you could use. Or as Chip kind of alluded to before, we were talking before we hit record here, if this person's going somewhere else for definitive care and you just need to keep them stable for that transport, then I think a SAM splint, which is, you know, basically it's a plastic and foam integrated device where you can kind of mold it and apply it in different ways here. That SAM splint is a great thing if they're just going to rip it off in about an hour when they get to definitive care and throw it in the trash. You don't necessarily have to expend your orthoglass for these.
Another part of this, and this is something that I learned quite a bit from having to do a number of these, is that when you do put on a splint, because it's something that's going to stay there for some period of time that you know is going to be longer than maybe an hour or two, is to make sure that you pad and smooth the areas of what you're applying. So basically your cotton batting and stuff like that, to avoid any secondary injuries. So keep in mind, bony prominences, you probably need to put some extra padding down. You may even go and get the thicker like cotton padding, which is a big, thick roll of stuff here, a couple of centimeters thick sometimes. Or just like I do a lot of times, I'll pick the thinner cotton batting because I can move with it more over these surfaces. But I'm making sure to put a lot of padding there. But also I make sure that that padding is going against the skin smoothly, because if it gets ruffled up and if it gets kind of layered in a way that can provide some pressure, even if it is something smooth like some padding, it can over time lead to some skin breakdown or other issues. So again, we want to avoid secondary injuries.
Yeah, it's like that children's book, The Princess and the Pea, right? The princess is laying on top of a mattress, but she feels the pea wearing against her back when she's sleeping on these mattresses here. So same kind of thing there. As kind of a sidebar of preventing secondary injury, there are certain regions of the body that should be splinted in either positions of function or other special positions where you're otherwise reducing tension on things like nerves and tendons. So just know what you're getting into when you're splinting certain structures of the body here. Again, the idea, the overarching principle here is we're trying to prevent secondary injury. That's our second principle here.
And then finally, oh, so important, is make sure you actually document the neurovascular status and, of course, perform it too. So I'm looking at neurovascular status both before and after I place the splint. And a big reason why is because it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. We want to be able to show that the patient wasn't harmed in any way by the splinting. And that's where I also like to type in the fact that the patient reports some relief after the splint has been placed and their neurovascular status has either improved, in some cases that might be the case, or at least remained stable.
Yeah, and it's important to check that early and often throughout your time, especially in the context of our next section here, which is pain control, which we're very passionate about here. You know, you want to give these, this says small doses intravenously. I'd prefer to say, frankly, just weight-based doses, okay? I think there are certain people who are, you know, giving morphine and it's 4 milligrams of morphine, no matter whether the patient is 100 pounds soaking wet or they're a 300-pound brute of a person here, it's always 4 milligrams of morphine. Like, I really think you can titrate that to effect a lot better when you look at the patient's weight there. And then you repeat as needed. I think giving that early is excellent for a lot of reasons here. Sometimes it's hard to get an IV. So what are our other options? We can get an IO. That's maybe a little bit aggressive just for pain control. I think it's maybe good for if we're worried about somebody being unstable, you go with IO, but not for pain control. So then what can you do? You can do intranasal opioids or other pain medications. You can even do oral. Oral morphines are very powerful with your immediate release capsules or tablets here, a very powerful way to provide high levels of pain relief. The next thing is doing a regional nerve block, okay? And I see Chip's on video here, and he's getting super excited because this is a great way to employ ultrasound to help patients with pain here. And before I let Chip tee off on this, this is why you want to check your neurovascular status very early, because if you block somebody and then you go, okay, well, now we're going to put a splint on you, let me check your neurovascular status before, and they go, yeah, I don't feel that. And you're like, oh yeah, because I blocked him. Did you feel it before I blocked you? You don't remember? Oh, okay. So that's kind of an awkward thing there. So be sure you're documenting that early and often as far as neurovascular status.
And that's something I do when I actually do regional nerve blocks, is I make sure to document hopefully at least a couple of times of like what their neurovascular status was. That way we can show at least a trend of what was going on prior to them being discharged in case of some rare iatrogenic event. Because they were blocked, they didn't really know. But generally, your blocks are going to be shorter lived anyways, oftentimes 2 to 6 hours. And so in the grand scheme of things, if you have someone who otherwise was appropriate and stable, it's probably not going to be a big thing. But keep in mind that when you use a regional nerve block to do so kind of wisely and think about what are the pros, what are the cons of this. But for me, regional nerve blocks, most of the time, this is going to be ultrasound guided. And I'm a huge fan, again, of ultrasound. So this is something I'm using. But I make sure to talk about like risk benefits. And also, it's important to remember that different nerve blocks will do different things. Some of them will only take out the sensory components. Some of them will also take out the motion part. They'll involve the motor component. And so I want to know motor sensation, which one's affected, how they're affected, and kind of plan from there. But also, it's really important just to double check your vascular status, because your vascular status shouldn't really change with a regional block. And one other thing I just want to talk about with pain control before we move on kind of to our final bit and wrapping up here is that, you know, we talked about morphine, but keep in mind there's any variety of opioids that we can use. I'm a huge fan personally of fentanyl. And then if that doesn't work, I'll move on to hydromorphone. But another option is, you know, keep in mind NSAIDs a lot of times would be appropriate. I'm also a fan of ketamine being used for pain control with patients. And there's still more options that we haven't really talked about. So sometimes, you know, just keep in mind, opioids are kind of a key component with this, but they're not the only thing. And some patients really absolutely refuse opioids, maybe because of their concern for addiction, or they may have a previous history of being an illicit user. And so we just want to make sure that we're honoring those wishes, but also coming up with ways around this. And that's actually sometimes where I'm doing nerve blocks is because I want to get pain control, and you know, either they're requiring a lot of pain control because they're opioid tolerant, or maybe they don't want opioids, or we're trying to look for just general ways of combining therapy. There's lots of ways that we can use nerve blocks to our advantage, but also other medications as well.
I like that a lot. Yeah. Well, something that goes along with what we're talking about earlier and checking neurovascular status with regards to the particular mechanism of injury here, there are other, you know, musculoskeletal injuries that go with certain musculoskeletal injuries here. So things like your posterior knee dislocation. So you can have that and a femoral fracture. Okay, or you can have a calcaneal fracture and you can have a spine injury, right? So again, it's important to know your associated injuries when you see a certain kind of mechanism of injury. Those are just two examples. We will have a great table for you in the show notes from the ATLS manual about associated injuries, what else you should be looking for, because the joke is the hardest fracture to detect is the second fracture, because we all get, you know, zoomed in on the first one.
All right. So kind of our last bit here, really quickly, occult skeletal injuries. So not all injuries can be diagnosed during the initial assessment. They can also be missed by plain film x-rays. So we just want to make sure that we can identify them through other imaging. The one that I think about the most that will be very deceptive in some cases would be like our tibial plateau fractures. And I have definitely caught the tibial plateau fracture that did not show up on x-ray, but man, did I find it on CT because of the clinical suspicion being there. But also, let's talk about for a second here, like kids, and sometimes they have those very subtle fractures that aren't seen on an x-ray. I might use ultrasound if I am lucky and be able to see a disruption of the cortex, which can be very, very subtle, but very helpful. But also if I still have concern of an occult fracture that I simply cannot see on whatever imaging modality, just keep in mind that when in doubt, splinting is not a bad idea and making sure that there's some kind of follow-up there. But also that we want to make sure that we have ways of being able to reassess this later, whether that's through primary care, orthopedics, but some way we want to make sure that occult fractures or occult injuries have some means of follow-up later on.
I'm real careful when I talk to patients about their x-rays. And what I say is, I don't say, hey, you didn't break anything. I say, we didn't see any fractures on the x-ray. There's always a possibility you could have something going on here, but we know at very least it's not displaced. It's not dislocated. The bones are, you know, anatomically positioned, but we have to worry about possible occult skeletal fractures, or I call them hidden when I'm talking to a patient. And I explain that it's not because we didn't do the right test. It's because there are certain limitations to x-ray technology. And so making sure that's clear to the patient, they understand, hey, look, if you're getting worse, if there are changes we don't expect you to be having, you got to come back to the ER. We want to see you again and try another go at this.
All right. So we are almost wrapped up with this podcast, but I want to point out something that I just saw a minute ago in the ATLS manual that I am proud of as a PA. And that is right before the bibliography. So like right at the end of the chapter, it says special thanks to Julie Gebhardt, PhD, for lead orthopedic physician assistant. And then it also then mentions the doctor, Ren Critchlow, orthopedic trauma surgeon at Ortho Indian St. Vincent Trauma Center, for all their help and collaboration with this project, as well as the provision of many of the photographs used in the chapter. To me, that is so awesome that the PA is actually listed there and listed first at that. So Julie Gebhardt, if you happen to be listening or if anyone knows of her, feel free to reach out. We'd be happy to talk to you some more, because that's just fantastic that you're mentioned in this chapter.
That's awesome.
All right. I think we've covered everything we possibly can. So as always, we're, you know, hovering around that hour or so mark, and that's good. We joked how this was probably going to be a shorter podcast, and once again, maybe not so much, but that's okay. So Mike, can you wrap us up here?
Yes. So the quick summary, again, the key here is this. You need to consider the possibility of musculoskeletal injury early, and don't get distracted by other things. Appropriately place your musculoskeletal injury and how quickly you need to address it in terms of the rest of the patient here. If you have a massive exsanguinating injury that you can quickly throw a tourniquet on and it's appropriate for that, go ahead and put the tourniquet on there. You're not going to hurt this patient. You're going to hurt him potentially more by letting him bleed out, by letting him lose more blood. We talked about studies that suggest higher limb loss, life loss, blood products used by delayed application of tourniquets here. So be aggressive with tourniquets here. We also need to be really appropriately aware of our associated both nerve injuries and other musculoskeletal injuries. Know the history, understand what happened, recreate the injury in your head after, of course, you've stabilized the patient, and understand what other things could be there that could suggest the need for additional x-rays, advanced imaging, perhaps even doing things like an ankle brachial index or CT angiogram. You want to make sure we're not missing those hidden injuries.
All right. All sounds good. So, Mike, why don't you give us the tagline, please?
Continue to provide early recognition and treatment of musculoskeletal injuries, and continue to provide total care everywhere.